Howdy, folks, and welcome to another episode of the Problematic Fave Podcast. This is your host, Dino Ray Ramos, and thank you for tuning in. Your patronage is very much appreciated. Anyways, we are at episode 2 of the second season as we welcome the wonderful journalist and critic, Amy Nicholson. She also is the co-host alongside Paul Scheer for the Unspooled podcast, which is a fantastic one. So tune into that after you listen to this episode, because Amy and I have the most intense deep dive analysis of one of the most unexpected movies I would expect to have a conversation like the one we just had. It's the movie Revenge of the Nerds. And there is a lot wrong with this one. Whew. So strap yourself in, because it's going to be one hell of a nerdy ride. Ugh. Oh, gross. I heard myself saying that too. I'm sorry.
Nerds!
Nerds.
Nerds.
Nerds!
What is a nerd?
Their action tonight demands an immediate retaliation.
How many cameras do we have left?
This should do it.
Oh, here she comes.
Go up, go up.
Oh, no. Oh!
That nerd saw me naked.
Nerds! Are all nerds as good as you?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Problematic Fave. This week, we have a wonderful guest, wonderful journalist, a wonderful critic, writer, podcast host, Amy Nicholson. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the pod.
Oh, hello. I guess I'll add to that list. Lover of a film that I know is deeply problematic, which I guess is why we're here to purge.
No, because we were just talking about this right before, because I totally understand why you picked this movie. And the movie in question is Revenge of the Nerds. So just a little bit about Revenge of the Nerds, directed by Jeff, is it Canu? I'm guessing, is that how you say it?
Yeah, the director of Troop Beverly Hills, another beloved classic of childhood.
Which totally makes up for this movie. And then some. He is also the editor of Ordinary People, which he's like a editor, or he was on the editing team or something like that. Anyways, the writing credits, there's a lot of people on this. There was a story by credit for Tim Metcalf, Miguel Tejada Flores, Steve Zacharias, and Jeff Buhai. But the screenplay was by Steve Zacharias and Jeff Buhai. I'm not familiar with their works at all. Amy, do you know anything off the top of your head that these people wrote?
Not really. That's been a thing that now that I'm older, I kind of want to go back and cross-reference all the movies that I saw when I was young. That I wasn't watching with any sort of auteur theory, in the 2000s and plus when I became a grown-up, I could be like, that's a Judd Apatow movie.
This is pre
me understanding that there are different directors and different writers for different things that made things that maybe are all of a sort or maybe not. So I have no idea what else they did.
I got this summary from, I think I got this one from Rotten Tomatoes. The summary goes, geeky college students Gilbert Anthony Edwards and Lewis Robert Carradine are evicted from their dormitory when the Alpha Betas, who recently burned down their own fraternity house by accident, confiscate the building. When the college forces the freshmen to live in the gym, Gilbert, Lewis, and their fellow dorks relocate to a rundown house. When the Alpha Betas, led by jock Stan Ted McGinley, repeatedly humiliate them, the nerds plot revenge. That, you know what? Reading that out loud, it's like, That plot story is just like wild and hilariously funny to me. I'm just like, wait, what? But Amy, what is your connection to this movie?
I mean, this is very much a movie that I saw on repeat at my grandparents' house during the summer on HBO. There's that specific genre of movie you saw on repeat when you were young, when you didn't have anything else to do. I'm an only child. I watched this movie a lot when I was very bored at my grandparents' house alone during the summer. Mm-hmm. And so it has always had kind of this deep place in my heart. And it's been a movie that I've revisited over and over again through the years. And, you know, there's the act of growing up and realizing, oh, wow, the things that I watched and felt uncomfortable about as a kid are actually even more uncomfortable than I thought they were. And then, you know, this to me is one of those movies that has grown and changed with me. And as recently as 10 years ago, I remember blowing somebody's mind by saying, like, this movie has a rape. And they're like, what? Because there's things you don't realize. And so mm-hmm. I kind of want to stay up at the start. One of the things I'm really interested in talking about, you know, here in this episode and about this movie is I think overall we tend to sit here like 2023 and be like, the past was just full of idiots, man. And sometimes I want to say, I can't tell if it was the past was full of idiots or just we were children. And I think we get these things mistaken. And I'm very curious about that.
Yeah. I was watching this and I think the most vivid thing I remember from this is an Asian man riding a little tricycle. And that's kind of like this, that's kind of one of the, and also a very effeminate Black man. Two identities that I have that, like, I was watching it younger. It's like, of course, I have like no kind of grasp of identity at that age. You know, we're children, you know, we're like around the same age. And like, I, like you, this was of that era of the Porkies, of that, like, hard bodies, like everything was horny, you know, it's like, what the hell? Everyone was horny. And, but like you said, it's like, was it just because we were children or is it like the past is it, you know, it's like, I was watching this movie and I was just like, this is a horrible movie, but I get it. Well, maybe Amy, you could explain it better since you're more of an expert on the movie.
Well, I'll start by saying this. The Rotten Tomatoes summary leaves out two important things. Mm. One, this isn't just a fight between the nerds and the alpha betas. This is a fight between the nerds, the alpha betas, and the pies. The sorority house, who also teams up with the alpha betas, who are also active aggressors. And they're also mean to the female nerd, like, counterpart, which is the Omega Moos.
Omega Moos, yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So this is actually like a four Greek quadrant, you know, war between them. And so at the top, what is complicated to me about this movie is part of what I admire about it that gets left out of plot summaries is feeds into what I loathe about it, you know, which is there are a lot of female characters in here who are really active. They're active in the persecution of the nerds and they're active in the defense of the idea of having a nerd identity. Mm-hmm. This movie is definitely like lumped into like the Porky's Lad universe. Mm-hmm. But I think what separates it from that is that it has so many women in there doing things besides just being stared at. So Betty Childs, the lead antagonist of the Pies, you know, Childs on its own being kind of like a creepy last name. She's a super, super active character in the destruction of the nerds. You know,
yes.
She brainstorms ways to torture them. She comes up with the idea of sending Gilbert and Lewis over to the frat house so that they can get tortured and told that they have to fuck sheep. You know, she.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. She like sets up a way of destroying the party that they throw. You know, she's, you know, ratting the guys out at every turn and making the jocks mad at them. So she's doing active things to help ruin their life. And just as the jocks are punished, she is punished, but she's punished in super sexual ways, you know,
yes,
that sometimes parallel. One of the ways they punish the jocks is they do a panty raid of the jock locker room, grab all their underwear, and then pour like hot poison jockish stuff on it. So they're freaking out.
Yeah.
And then they do a panty raid to the women. It's just the panty raid is much more sexual. And then they go further. They spy on the women. They take pictures of the women. They sell pictures of the women without their consent. And then Betty is raped. Mm-hmm. Whew. And the circumstances of the rape are that. Oh, God. And I'm going to back up on 1 second. I want to say this is not at all an excuse. I'm explaining it, I think, in the context of what the movie means, which is Betty is selling kisses to win the prize for the Greek council. Our quote-unquote hero Gilbert Lewis. I want to make sure I really separate these because Gilbert and Lewis are very, very different characters, which is the thing I'm also very interested in getting into. Lewis is the one played by Robert Carradine, the one who thinks he's not a nerd, thinks he's pretty cool, thinks he honestly has a shot with Betty, which is just bewildering.
Yes.
And spends most of the movie defending Betty and thinking she must be a good person deep down. And you're like, no, no, Lewis, you're just a really broken man. So he goes up to Betty and in the logic of the movie, gives her money for a kiss and she refuses to kiss him. So the scene starts with this idea of she cheated me, right? Mm-hmm. She cheated me of some action. And then Betty's Betty's boyfriend. Yeah. Betty's boyfriend, Tim McGinley, famous Stan. From Married with Children. Yeah.
Stan, right?
She tries to hit on her boyfriend and her boyfriend's like, you're a goat. You just want to fuck all the time, you know? And so she's a little offended. Her like sexuality has been dismissed by her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And then Lewis realizes that he and Stan are dressed kind of alike because it's a Halloween costume. Stan is dressed like Darth Vader in this black cape. Lewis is wearing a black cape and a top hat. Maybe he's like Phantom like a of magician. The Opera or a magician.
I think vampire or something. Yeah, there was similar things. Yeah.
And he realizes if he takes the Darth Vader mask, he can pursue Betty into a funhouse. She'll think that he is her boyfriend and she'll have sex with him. And what turns out happening is she does. But yet the sex is somehow, in 80s logic, so magical. And we get the sense so giving because apparently Stan is a selfish frat boy lover that she is immediately in love with a nerd. Says she's in love with him by the end of that day, asks him out on a date, and he has that line. You know, jocks only think about sports.
Yes.
Nerds think about sex. And I really believe in 80s mentality, we are supposed to think, yeah, the nerds really care about female pleasure. But no, that's not at all what's happening in here.
It's like watching that now, my stomach was churning. But it's like, you go back to the question you were asking earlier. It's like, oh, did we just not know better back then? And I think that's right. But also we should have known better because I was like, I was looking at this movie, you know, you kind of pretty much summed it up. It's like kind of after they have sex and she's like, all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, you're such a good lover. Let's be boyfriend, girlfriend. It's like, oh, ew, you know? And then after that, pretty much like, everything kind of falls into place, right? And you know, but like watching this, I was just like, I'm like, oh, I get what this movie was like this really interesting allegory of like inclusion and the ostracizing of the othered. And it got really intense when it was just basically like at that one point when they, I guess they're having a party or they burn a sign that says nerds outside of their house. And I was like, that's basically a burning cross, right? I was just like, oh, this movie is way intense, but it's like treating like this topic with like this lightness that kind of makes it easy to kind of consume. Whereas like, oh, it's a really kind of sad story. Like, it's like, oh my God, we are horrible human beings.
Yeah, it's fascinating, right? Because this is a movie that is so much at its core trying to say something about discrimination and marginalized groups. And, you know, making the point as clumsily as it does that, like, one of the things that makes this group of people outcasts and nerds is that none of them are accepted by fraternities. And the people who aren't accepted by fraternities include the stereotypical nerds, but also do include, like,
people of color.
The people of color and people of different sexual orientations. And they are making that point that all of these people fall under discrimination. And then they're using this imagery that is truly wild. You know, the cross burning, the idea of them being like interned in gyms, you know, referring to it as like almost war zone refugees. Women are thrown in water, or people are thrown in water like they're witches. They're stripped naked. They're tortured. Yes. They act like the word nerd is a slur you shouldn't say throughout the film. Like, they keep trying to correct themselves. Like, they accidentally said the wrong N-word. You know?
Yeah. Oh my God. That's so wild. Yeah.
It's so wild because you can feel that they're trying to do something progressive. But then today we're like, you're doing something progressive about these mostly white and straight men. And who cares? That, you know, because today that's how we feel about it. Because today we're looking at it like, sorry. Oh God. Now I'm on a rant.
Go ahead.
Today we're like, we see Gilbert and Lewis and we're like, instantly, I can't get rid of the idea that these guys suck because they're going to grow up to be absolute jerks who dominate our culture, you know?
Yes.
You can't help but look at them and be like, these are like presaging incels or gamer gators, pickup artists, guys who can't get like their dates. And so I don't want to stick up for their feelings today in 2023. Like,
no, definitely
nerdy
not.
White hetero men. But it believes so genuinely that it's likening it to this historical idea of oppression and civil rights struggles, which is insulting, but wild, but also fascinating. And like, that's what I just am fascinated by in this. I will end my rant in a second. But that when you make something in its day that you feel like you're doing something progressive, it's those movies are the first to think they're doing something progressive that are the first to look outdated. You know,
because, like, oh my God,
Blazing
so
Saddles
true.
Or Brokeback Mountain or Easy A or something like that. It's easier to be the guy who just makes Porky's and it's all lame white straight guys from the beginning. So it's like this dilemma is what I am fascinated by this film.
Yeah. And in this weird way, something like Revenge of the Nerds is kind of timeless because of its like errors and because of its like, because they put such a heavy sheen of like a nerd. And I love how you said the other, because this like this N-word, right? It's like weird. It's like, I wonder if these writers even thought of that, because I'm not sure, you know, what race, ethnicity they are, but they seem like, I think, well, one of them seems like there may be Latino just based on the name alone, but from otherwise, it feels like they're all white cis men, right? And to come from a time in this 80s era where it's like, I'm like, now I'm looking back at that era of like Porky's and this Revenge of the Nerds franchise and those B movie like Hard Bodies and, you know, all these kind of movies. I'm like, oh, what were we trying to say back then when, you know, like everyone was like, this was like horny from the top. Like everyone's horny, boobs, like, the boobs in this movie are out of control. Like, it's just like, I'm not a prude or anything. I'm just like, okay, wow, it's so gratuitous. There you go. That's the word I'm looking for.
We don't see casual boobs in the same way in movies anymore. I mean, I think we did up until like, what, 2008, maybe. I'm going to throw a date out there. Yeah, and then we stopped seeing casual boobs.
Casual boobs. I like casual boobs.
I mean, because
like
this is made around the same time that, like...
84.
And 84 is around the same time that... Why am I blanking on the name of a director I love? Amy Heckerling was making Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And she was told specifically from the studio that she has to have, and I'm going to make up a number of boobs, but I think it was like 5 boobs. Like, she has to have 5 boobs in this movie. It was a mandate to put boobs in your movie.
The boob mandate. I did not know this. Yeah. And also, and then I of course I was there. I have Fast Times on Criterion and watched it with the commentary, and they were really fighting her on the full frontal of the male, right? And I think there are 2 versions. I think the Criterion one, you could see it all, but I think like the regular version, they kind of, I may be wrong on that, but that was a big old deal when that actor, I forgot his name, and Jennifer Jason Leigh have sex in the Full House.
Yeah, a scene that almost got that movie rated X, when you're like, yes! It's a sex scene like all the others, but you're doing it from the female point of view. And so then everybody lost their mind and they're like, what do you mean? This isn't fun. Like, it's going to be fun.
The nakedness doesn't need to mean something, you know, but it's like, but that's kind of what made Fast Times at Ridgemont High kind of subverted what all this has done, like Revenge of the Nerds and Porky's, where they were just having gratuitous boobs. All that was from the male point of view. And here comes Amy Heckerling like, oh, nah, this is actually could tell a story.
Exactly.
Instead of being gratuitous.
And it's like, I don't want to give the directors of Revenge of the Nerds too much credit, but this is a movie from this era where the women, the Omega Moose, I think are always forgotten when you talk about this movie, always forgotten. The Omega Moose are rad. And the Omega Moose are, you know, they are also sexually interested in men, you know, they have desires, and you get the sense that like nerdy girls don't always get to, oh God, now I'm going to talk like nerdy girls don't always get to get laid too. I'm just going to talk in the parlance of this film. And this movie does show that nerdy girls also want love. That's not
I love that.
Genius, but it is not seen in these movies.
It's like the most normal people in this movie were the Omega Moose.
I love the Omega Moose.
Yeah. And it's like, we barely get to see them. What Lewis ends up with, I forgot.
Judy, the Omega Moose. Or Gilbert. Gilbert winds up with Judy.
Gilbert.
Lewis sucks. Okay. Gilbert's great.
Gilbert is Gilbert Goose. There you go. Gilbert Goose. Yeah. Anthony Gilbert Edwards.
Gilbert Goose is wonderful. He meets Judy at the computer lab. They seem to have a really sweet romance. He has that line in there that I think is almost the mantra of the movie, because she's saying that she's scared of computers and he's like, only humans can be inhuman.
It's no use. It's inhuman.
Oh, it's not human. Only humans can be inhuman. Here, let me show you.
Oh, yeah, I see, like, I think Anthony Edwards was like the perfect, like, I liked him a lot, whereas Lewis, which Carradine is that again? I forgot.
Robert.
For everyone who doesn't know, he's of the Carradine Empire. His dad is his dad.
Uncles. I get the Carradines all confused.
David Carradine was Kung Fu, and
right,
he played the titular Kill Bill.
Right.
So Robert Carradine is.
He's almost like perfect casting, because when they cast him for this, he said, this is his quote, "I'm not a nerd. I'm probably a guy who would beat up a nerd."
And so
crazy, right? I'm gonna send you a picture of what he looked like at this time. And you'll be like, you're not correct, but I can see why you might have thought so.
He's giving so incel. It's like, let's not forget that Mr. Carradine's dad in the movie. Ew.
Got the picture.
Yes. Wait, this was him?
This is him. He's got that, like, I think I'm handsome hairdo.
Yeah, it's like, for the listener, it's a feathered moment, feathered like Donny Osmond almost moment, right? He looks like he would be an alpha beta.
He does. Right? He looks like he thought he was an alpha beta for sure.
Yeah, but then like he got the make under. Or not, whatever you want to call it. He got made into a nerd.
He got glasses on him. The idea.
The whole glasses situation.
Yeah. But it's true. Like, he had this idea that when he put on his nerd costume for this movie, people would be like, you look ridiculous. What a costume. And he'd be a little self-conscious about it. But he put on his costume and people just accepted that he was a nerd. And he was almost more horrified. And I think that it was Curtis Armstrong, the actor who played Booger.
Booger, yeah.
Who looked at, Robert Carradine when he was in costume, and he was like, oh, I get it. You're playing this as though he doesn't know that he's a nerd. And that's just him describing how Robert Carradine was even wearing the costume. And then he folded that, I think, into the Lewis character.
Wow.
Because Lewis just sucks. Lewis sucks.
It's like, you know how there's always the two friends of a lead in like a movie who are like best friends? There's always the one that sucks, but doesn't really suck. But he like really, really sucks. Like, Gilbert, find another buddy. You'd be better off. Like, I would rather see Gilbert and Booger BFFs. You know, that's more realistic to me.
I mean, and there's like Gilbert, I think, towards the end, there's this lovely bit where like they do kind of separate, and Lewis is broken and cynical. Mm. They've pillaged the house. He doesn't think he got the girl. And it's Gilbert who suddenly kind of steps forward as like the moral hero. You know, he's like, things will change. He's the one who like goes and like takes that final confrontation at like the bonfire for homecoming. And it is Gilbert, the good one, the good nerd, who, you know, finally becomes president of the student council. And I am so glad it's not Lewis, because it feels kind of like it's more Lewis's film. But at the end, the poem goes to Gilbert. It goes to the good one. And it's, you know, Gilbert is the one who gets that line. No one's really going to be free until nerd persecution ends.
Any of you that have ever felt stepped on, left out, picked on, put down, whether you think you're a nerd or not, why don't you just come down here and join us, okay? Come on.
No one's really going to be free until nerd persecution ends.
Which is like such a, like, that's when you know they're like, they just replace whatever slur minority with nerds. You know, it's like, I like that about this. Like, I love this movie about how it's almost like I guess a satire or like very much a very hardcore skewering of like the story of like privilege and toxic masculinity. And I wrote down when I was writing notes about this and watching it, I was all, it's a story about inclusivity and acceptance done totally wrong. And it's because it's doing so many good things. And the actor Ewan Jefferson, who is, I guess, the allows like
the
them
of
to,
the,
yeah,
the Lambda, historically Lambda, back Lambda fraternity, though.
Hold it, coach. You just hold it right there.
Yeah.
The pointed idea that only the historically black fraternity will accept them on a trial basis. But then honestly, only because they didn't see a picture. And even UN, the head of the historically black fraternity, is like, you guys are nerds. And I actually think you're too awful to be with us. There's something kind of like, there's something very pre Black Lives Matter in this yes. idea of like, we solved everything, you know, like everything's fine in the black community now. They're fine. It's the nerds who are persecuted.
Yes. Yes. It's like, yeah. But it's like, oh, I was writing this. So like for everyone, like basically Ewan, what's that actor's name? We've seen him in.
Oh,
like,
who plays Ewan?
Yeah.
It is.
Oh, where is it? I have it written down somewhere as well. Bernie Casey as Ewan Jefferson. What a name. Ewan Jefferson, like United Nations, I'm guessing uh-huh. is what they were going for, to help unite everyone who lets like the nerds become a chapter of Lambda, Lambda, Lambda. I guess a black fraternity. I was watching that because, like, I think when he called them and he said, "We, you know, we're allowing you to, you know, become a chapter here," I was all, "Oh, that's cool." But also, what you were saying is like, "All, oh, this black fraternity is taking on the burden of the nerd community now." It was like, "Oh, wait, I get what they're doing, but it just is so." Problematic is this movie is layered upon beyond belief.
It really is. And there's moments where you know that the movie knows what it's doing, that like they invite you into their fraternity to try to show them that they can have a cool party, right? Doesn't go
yes!
well for a very long time. And then Lewis is like, I'm gonna make these guys feel more comfortable, and he puts Swing Low Sweet Chariot
yes!
on. And it is Lamar, you know, our black and queer member of the nerd community, who is like, oh God. And he just runs over there, switches out the album, and he gives UN this look of like, they're idiots, I'm sorry.
That exact scene is in my notes. Like, I was just like, Lamar is like, oh, he rushes, and he's like, he like gives that look, sorry, you know, and they immediately have this, you know, kind of like a, we understand. And I think UN was, you know, one of the few characters in this movie that showed empathy towards the nerds. And that kind of speaks highly of his character because, you know, obviously he's black and he knows what, you know, kind of struggle, I guess. But they're using that in the wrong way in this context. But, you know, again, it's just like all the 80s were a wild time, and us as children watch this kind of stuff, and our baby boomer parents were all, it's fine.
It's fine. Yeah, I mean, like, what turns Ewan around is that he's impressed that the nerds fought back, put stuff on the jock straps, raided the girls' room, and he's like, you fought back, and now you're cool. You know, that's like the 80s culture. Like, you threw some punches, you did some bad stuff too, good. Now you're tough. Like, it was like that stand up, fight your bully, get it all done kind of macho culture, I guess. But it's interesting too, because like Ewan is not painted as like being innately good. Like, he doesn't step in as being like, I'm the greatest hero and I'm very open minded. I appreciate that they make the Ewan character a little bit like, you are nerdy. I don't know how I feel about that. They have that scene where they're like pitching themselves as like, please let us join Lambda, Lambda, Lambda. I think it's Gilbert the good one who says, you know, in our chapter we'll be open to all races and creeds, and then Lamar yeah. pops up and he goes, and sexual orientation, and you can see Ewan blink, you know, it's not like absolutely yes,
yeah, he's just like
okay,
it's kind of like he knows he's doing a good thing but he's very uncertain about it,
yeah.
that kind of thing, right? But also it's like watching, I think when they said that, I was like, oh, wow. Oh, I was like, that's kind of cool. That was happening back then. right? But then I'm like, oh, then I look in 2023 and I'm like, oh, we're still having kind of that same conversation right now, but with a lot more politics, a lot more nuance, and a lot more anxiety. I think just because as the movie was ending, I was all, I want to see this whole movie through UN's perspective, because because I was just like, oh, imagine, like, he's like this, he's kind of like a I don't give a fuck, but also I give a fuck kind of mentality. He knows what he's doing, but he's a fascinating character. He was the only character I was all, more of him. He knows what's wrong here, and he just can't say out loud.
That's true. There's a whole universe happening inside UN that I would love to just, but he doesn't say anything, almost. He just kind of so carries silent. It silently.
Yeah.
And yeah, I want to hear UN's take on it.
Well, first off, when, you know, they're nerds and they're going to college, right? I was just like, oh, by that time in my life, I was like, the whole nerd jock kind of hierarchy was like out of my, I'm like, oh, this wouldn't happen today. But also I was like, oh, I get it. I would rather this have taken place in high school or something. But then you couldn't have all the boobs if, you know, if it was, wait, Porky's was in high school, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. But wasn't it high school in the 50s, which is, I always find really weird. Or I feel like it was past high school. Like they were making these movies, this and Animal House, where they're Animal, like, House. It's today, but it's in the past. And I don't know why they do that.
They were like 40-year-olds playing high schoolers, basically, yeah, kind of ordeal. But well,
yeah. And what's weird about it is, like, I kind of lump these movies together. Like, you know, I'll go in reverse order. Nerds, Porky's, Animal House, and then MASH. These, like, real lads running around movies. Uh-huh. MASH, I feel like, you know, they're at war, so it's different. But it's also, I think it's the MASH energy that becomes Animal House. And it's weird because I hate all of those movies except Revenge of the Nerds. In Revenge of the Nerds, when you stack them next to each other, you're like, this is trying something different. I mean, the Deltas in Animal House just suck. They're just awful. Yeah. And, like, Belushi is basically Ogre. There's no difference there. He's, like, Ogre with a little bit of, you know, Ogre with a little bit of booger.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they basically are the Deltas. You know, this movie comes out, like, only 6 years after Animal House. I can the jerk, nihilist, white guy, awful frat that's supposed to be the underdogs and our heroes in Animal House just becoming the bad guys in this one. There's really no difference.
Yeah.
So Revenge of the Nerds marks like an evolution, but it is still a total mess.
Yeah, it's I think the intention of Revenge of the Nerds at the time was like, oh, this movie is standing up for the little guy, right? It's like all the nerds who kind of just want to be human and love the nerd that we see in Gilbert, I think, is what, you know, the nerd I kind of focus on. Lewis is just disgusting, but Lewis fit the profile, you know, physically. Like, he's the nerd. He's the poster child of nerddom. So they're going to go to him first, you know, before Gilbert.
Sure.
Yeah, before Gilbert even gets thought about.
And what I think is so funny is, like, you could take either Gilbert or Lewis's outfits and they would belong. Do you follow league fits? This is like what some NBA players are wearing now. Like, Russell Westbrook would wear either of these outfits minus the pocket protector.
Yes.
And I adore that. I love that. I think that's so funny.
A lot of, like, yeah, this kind of, I don't know why pocket protectors, I guess, became a nerdy thing. And, like, you know, like through the 90s, even through Saved by the Bell and stuff, you know, pocket protectors were like the badge of a nerd. And I'm like, oh, where did that even start? Like, pocket protectors are probably genius. You know, it's like, right? They protect you. Because back in the day, I'm guessing you would put your pens and they would link ink. And that's why they protect your pocket. But
why do men put their pens now? Like, I have a purse, but I don't know why. I mean, men have to visibly carry their pens around. What's going on?
I don't know, because we all have phones now. So, no, there was a period of time where I did not use digital calendars, that I actually had a book and I would write my schedule in it. And I feel like such a gentleman, you know, and I still actually handwrite in a journal and like a moleskin and all that. I kind of like this tactile media stuff, you know. I like it. And I remember a long time ago, I always tell this story because I really love it. During the Fruitvale Station, when that came out, and right. I was living in the Bay Area at the time, and obviously they had the National Press Junket there, and I was interviewing Ryan Coogler at the time, and I had a moleskin, and I was writing it when he walked in, and he was all, "You like those, don't you?" And I was all, "What?" I was like, "Oh, what?" And he was like, "Oh, those moleskins," and he was all, "I love them." He was like, "Oh, because it makes you feel like what you're writing is very important." And I was all, "Oh!" And from what I understand, I met with one of his colleagues recently, Sev Ohanian, who is, you know, I think I know he's a producer and stuff. And I told him that story, and he was all, "He still writes in moleskin." And I was all, "Oh!" I just love handwriting sometimes. Do you still handwrite?
I can't read my handwriting worth anything. I mean, I have to, like, you know, because I see movies in the dark and I have to take notes in the dark. But then just today I was trying to type up notes from a movie I saw, and I lost like maybe 7 or 8 ideas because I just don't know what I said.
One time someone did give me a pen that glows and I could write. But I was all, that's a distraction in the theater, though, still. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know anybody who would use it. That seems kind of rude.
Yeah. And also, I get what you're saying, because when I'm taking notes, I lose probably about 75% of, or it will say something like stupid center person. And it, like, I have to kind of piece together because the writing is all over the page, you know, the words. But okay. Sorry about the.
We just got into a really nerdy talk. Oh, God. We are the nerds now.
We are the nerds, and we will not stand for this oppression. That was the silly part of it. It was like, oh my God, nerd oppression. I was like, oh, this is such an 80s idea, right? And now being a nerd is cool. As you were talking about the outfits, yeah.
Because it is kind of predicting where the power will go. Mm-hmm. These guys are going to become the billionaires. Like, watching it, I sort of felt like the alpha betas are going to go into politics and the nerds are going to dominate our culture forevermore online, in money, invent our things. We can't escape the nerd world. So it's like these two dominant things kind of battling it out. And I'm curious about that.
Ooh.
You know,
because they're Silicon Valley and then they're DC, right? It's like,
right?
Yeah, these nerds are going to become the Twitter and the Elon Musks and the Mark Zuckerbergs and the, you know, Steve Jobs of the world, right? Whereas.
Exactly.
These other guys are going to become the John McCain's and the, you know, Rush Limbaugh's and Jesus Christ.
The Brett Kavanaugh's.
Kavanaugh's. Oh, my God. You're so right.
Yeah. Wesley Morris wrote a great piece about Porky's and how Porky's is Brett Kavanaugh. You know, men laughing at women in humiliating, painful, embarrassing situations and not giving them any help.
Oh, and my,
like,
God.
That it is. That's when he was in law school. And it just is that culture. This is the culture of Brett Kavanaugh.
It's kind of like we're finally seeing, you know, the fruits of Revenge of the Nerds' labors. Like, these are the people running our country and our culture right now, in terms of, like, culture when it comes to, like, tech. And so, because I easily could see, like, Zuckerberg being Lewis. I'm not lying. Yeah, right?
Right? Right.
So sorry, I'm not. I, that may be a hot take, but it's not like exactly. But I see the energy there, this weird energy.
No, it's true, and yet there's, like, I think still so much here that, to me, this movie is a great example of. You know, I heard somebody say the other day that they're not interested anymore in cancel culture; they're interested in context culture. Uh-huh. Where it's like, I'm fascinated by the context of
this
movie, even though a lot of it grosses me out, which I guess I feel like we should really talk about. I feel like we should really, really talk about Tekashi and Lamar.
I think that was, like, on my bullet points too, just because the first thing, obviously, I mentioned it earlier, it's like one of the main things, as I remember, is seeing this Asian man riding a tricycle, right? And that wasn't my first moment of seeing Asian representation. I always trace back to Short Round. And Short Round is, we talked about Short Round in an episode of Problematic Fave with Sujata Day about Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and how that movie is problematic. But at the same time, we talked
Spielberg
about
hates women when he made that movie. You can I'm going through a divorce. Fuck everybody. He's so mad.
That was his Taylor Swift song, right? Mm-hmm. That was his that was his thing. But when me and Sujata talked about that movie, we were talking about Asian representation in Short Round and how he was seen as an equal to Indy in that. And now looking back in retrospect, that's why I've always kind of stuck by Ke Huy Quan all the way up to Everything Everywhere All at Once, right? But he was the representation I saw. What's the character's name?
Takashi is played by Brian Tochi.
Okay.
Yeah.
So seeing him as like, oh, this is a different, this was like a humiliating representation of, it's like very much yellow face, very much, you know, not by 2023 standards, you know, representational at all. At one point, he's wearing an Indian headdress, an Indian Native American garb, and playing a gong. And when I saw that, I was all, dear Lord Jesus Christ. I was all, that is horrid. And then when it comes to Lamar, I was reading something on the actor,
Larry B. Scott,
who I remember also from Space Camp, which I love that movie. And he was also in a lot of other 80s stuff. He was like very hyper present during that time. But that character, I think I was reading how he said he was too butch and he had to fem it up a lot, you know, for that role.
Right, because he's straight. Yeah. I think like the actress who played Betty said that he made a point of like hooking up with as many women as he could during the shooting of the film. So they had to be like, this is not, I'm playing a character.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that. That yeah. is horrid. That is like kind of to like, I'll imagine like if, but now isn't it funny? But now all straight cis males, like they were like, I'll play a gay guy. I'll play a, you know, trans person, even though I'm not, you know?
Yeah. And now we're like, you don't stop. We don't even need you to do that.
Yeah. We don't need yeah. you to do that, but they want yeah. to, because it will give them an Oscar, Jared Leto.
Yeah. Like,
but like, here, it's kind of interesting to hear that Larry B. Scott had to kind of prove his masculinity while playing a queer character, which is, imagine how that would, I don't know, I would say that would just mess with my head a little bit.
He's kind of talked about a lot of the public response to it, you know, like, mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things he said is like, I wanted to play this role because all I was getting at the time was like stereotypical violent dude parts. Yeah. You know, and so I wanted to do a part where I could show that I could act, that I could play different characters than like, you know, guy with gun number 36.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took this role for that. But then he said he got these really polarizing responses afterwards. Like, I'm going to read some quotes from him. He said,
Yeah.
Back then I got shunned by a lot of the brothers. Now it's fine. Everybody loves me. But they were thinking, we finally got a brother on screen and he has to be gay. And they're really upset with him for that. Yeah. But then he said also, quote, I can't tell you how many times gay guys have come up to me and said, thank you. You've held our flag up so high. You know, but then after that, he said every script he got was, can you be gay? And he got really concerned about being typecast. He was offered the really big role in Mannequin and then turned it down. It's been this like complicated bit for him. And I mean, Lamar, that character is like, on the one hand, I want to say like, good on Lamar, because like, yes. I like the idea that here's this ensemble and like, he's foundational. He's Black and queer, but he's just foundational to this ensemble. Yeah. He's there in all of the scenes throughout the way. All of his scenes are not all about him being Black and queer. He's just there helping clean the house, living his life. And like, in a way, I want to say, like, I admire that this character is never asked to change. He never changes. He just
I love that too.
Mm-hmm. You know? And they almost mm-hmm. work with him. And, like, there's that, like, the scene that is the most about him being Black and queer is, like, the javelin, where they design a javelin for his javelin toss that works with what they call, like, his limp-wristed.
Limp wrist.
Worms is a master at aerodynamics, and he designed the javelin to go along with Lamar's limp-wristed throwing style.
You're like, ouch. You know, it's one of those lines where you're like, oh, God.
It's and like, oh, you were almost there. You were almost there making this, just kind of it's, this good character. Yeah.
Because it's like terrible, but you want to give it the benefit of the doubt of saying it's also a metaphor for we accept you and here's what you can do with what you are. You know, like, ugh. But it's weird. It's gross. But then they also give him, he's not just like black and queer and neutered. He's like, he gets to bring a date to the party. They like dance and have fun the whole night. You know, like they show him as a person with a boyfriend and not just like the gay best friend in almost every other 80s movie who doesn't get a date. Mm. And it's like, every good thing they do a bad thing. And it's so complicated.
Yeah. It's like, I think out of the whole nerd ensemble, Lamar is the only one who is certain of who he is, I feel like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like he's the only one confident with who he is. He's black, he's queer, but also does he say I'm gay at all in the, I don't think he does, right? I think it's during this time when saying that out loud is like it's like, you know, what Florida's trying to do right now, or is doing. But it's so interesting because when I was watching, it's like, he feels the most comfortable in his skin. He feels the most, he doesn't give a fuck of what anyone says, especially when he was doing the javelin and it says to fit his limp-wristed throwing style. And I was all, is that even a thing? And it's like, it goes back to this kind of like, this is what gay looks like. And then also to put that on a black man makes it even like, we have 2-for-1 here, you know? That kind of thing. It's like, gross. But I feel like the character of Lamar has, although not perfectly, very not perfectly portrayed, it is like way light years better than Takashi, you know?
Yeah.
Takashi was just a joke the whole time, you know? Even like when him and Booger are playing poker and he says, I have a frush. And obviously that's racist. Like, you know, racist accents.
Okay, Takashi, what do you got?
Well, I think I have a frush.
What the fuck is a frush?
A frush.
Oh, well, see, I got 2 sevens, and 2 sevens beats a frush.
Oh, thank you.
This is so low-hanging fruit. But as you said, context culture, right? It's just like, this is where we were at in that time, and it still kind of resonates today in this weird, but it's kind of like we pivoted from like being blatantly racist to being coded racist.
Right?
Yeah.
And like, I should say actually, as like weird context for me, my undergrad thesis from film school was on depictions of Japanese men in 80s films.
Wow.
Yeah. Because it was a whole thing, you know, of course, like the John Hughes movies, you know, 16 Candles, all of it. And, you know, the argument I made at the paper was a lot of it was like, this is a moment where we were terrified that Japan was going to take us over with the auto industry, terrified that Japan was going to dominate the economy going forward, and consciously, subconsciously took it out by putting Asian characters into movies and then emasculating them in every single way we could think of to be like, you might be winning the auto wars or American cars or whatever, Toyota's over here, but we will show that you are not real men compared to us. And it's like, it's in all of them. It's in so many movies. And I feel like Takashi is one of the worst ones because it just like, it makes me so sad that they like take that character and then make him also repellent. Like he's the one who is taking gross pictures of ladies' crotches and yelling hair pie over and over again. You know, they make him like a child. And in a way, I want to be like, they make him sweet. Like, sweetness is his operating thing. Like, he's, like, trusting. But that's, like, in an immature, childish way where he just gets manipulated over and over again.
Yeah,
it
and it's, like,
really rough.
Like, I think that goes to the whole, like, you know, emasculation of the Asian male kind of thing, which is, like, totally has done a 180 since then. Now it's, like, all... No, you know, like, with the upcoming Joyride, you know, that's going to... That, you know, that blatantly just like, these men are just here as eye candy, period. We don't give a fuck about them. And rightfully so.
Yeah.
And with Stephen Yeun, like Crazy Rich Asians, you know, like I remember like they lingered on a lot of the body shots for the women, you know, like, you know, in Crazy Rich Asians. But now back in the 80s, it's like, oh, either this just kind of goes back to the whole, you know, Asian males are, you know, are sexless, you know, they're just there. And that's such an interesting thing that I feel like is still being worked out today. But then it was just like, oh, at least Lamar was treated like a human. I don't think Tekashi was. He was treated as a pet.
Okay, come on.
You feeling okay, Sashiro?
Oh, fucking great.
Go,
oh.
Go.
Step aside, Mama. I want to see some of that muff.
Oh, hair pie, hair pie.
I think so, too. And, like, yeah. The actor, Brian Tochi, you know, he has said that he got, and this is his quote again, like, I got so much shit from Asian entities, newspapers, commentators, groups, saying that I perpetuated the Asian stereotype. Mm-hmm. You know, and he said, what made it different for me is, first of all, I was one of the very few Asian actors in TV or film. Mm-hmm. And it's like that dilemma of the 80s. Like, do you take the role? Do you not take the role? It's everything that a couple of years later, you know, they were exploring in the movie. Oh, gosh. I just like that. We just talked about this on my show. I'll get to it later. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like in this 80s time, there weren't a lot of good characters. And what do you do?
I identify
Omega Mu, you know, there were some of us, we were there, we were getting made fun of, but like there I am, but like it's tricky.
Yeah, it's, but I like empathize with actors and the choices they have to make, and I and especially now, imagine like now compared to then, it's like everyone is ready to say you're wrong for doing X, Y, and Z. Say like, oh, why did you choose this role? Why did you do it that way? It's like everyone is kind of, now we are at a good time for like Asian representation, but now there comes the conversation is like, oh, who gets to represent Asian community? How is it representative? Why is it, you know, then you get into kind of the siloed, there's just like this whole thing. But back then it was like, Asian is just that, you know? So yeah. It's, and then, but now Asian is more than that, but it's like we're still sorting through, you know, the possibilities, whereas there was only that possibility back then. And I think that I get why Brian took this job. It's like the same reason why, you know, on 16 Candles, the actor Getty,
Watanabe,
why he continued to choose those roles, and they were the only, and those were the only roles that they had, and no one told them, and they weren't writers, and you know, they couldn't make their own stuff, because now it's a totally different ball game. But back then it was just like, oh, oof.
Yeah.
You're like, right. Oof.
Hollywood Shuffle, that was the movie I was trying to think of with Robert Townsend, and it's like,
oh,
3 years later, and it's all about trying to be a Black actor in Hollywood and only being offered like really demeaning roles. And it's one of those movies where it's so right on that conversation and then horrible to women and non-straight people.
Yeah.
You know, where just, trying to say something that's important and progressive for the time, but backwards in so many other ways.
I just think even just as a story, as a general movie, this movie, like taking out all the problematic stuff, I was like, oh, this is a, please do not quote me and saying like, I love all the bad stuff, but I think that the movie is fun for what it is. Like if you take out this like kind of format of it, it just feels like the series of like cat and mouse. I'm like a volleying of like little bits and little jokes. And other than that, I think for the time, in context, this is what constituted as excellent entertainment, right?
I mean, I feel like it, because I feel like the even a worse version of this movie would have ended with them winning the contest, ta-da, everything's great. You know, that would be the 80s ending. Like, we win, we're on stage, it's wonderful. But then this movie goes two steps further to like the destruction of their house at the end, the kind of sacking and pillaging.
Yes.
And then this idea that we are all nerds together in this community thing. It's like, it's the Dean gets a chance to step up and like fight against, you know, his kind of oppression at this college, like, with the jock squad. And I will say, I went to a public college where like the football team carried a lot of weight, very familiar.
Yeah, and me too. Texas yeah. A&M.
Oh, University of Oklahoma. What's yes. up, Aggie? Sooners and Aggies reunite, yeah. man. Yes. We're very close to each other. We could have toilet papered each other's friends.
Yeah, we could have stolen each other's mascots.
Yeah. That it's a real specific type of college that this mm-hmm. one I think comes close to. Like, I mean, I would say
That kind of rapport or like rivalry, right? Within yeah. colleges and the stupid things we used to do, like the traditions. Like, for instance, this, I was all, what the fuck is a homecoming carnival? And I was all, okay, I get it. But it's like, oh, because, you know, A&M famously had a bonfire, remember? Uh-huh. You know, the really tall one, and then the tragedy happened. Unfortunately, I went to school when the tragedy happened, when the bonfire fell.
Oh my God.
Right. It was that day was like, oh, holy shit. But they still have, you know, a version of the bonfire. They have all these traditions. And I see that kind of college culture in here. And I was like, these kinds of movies were like, oh, were these kinds of movies trying to kind of program us what to expect or what we should be doing in college? We should be fitting in one area or another. But I just was like, oh, I'm not going to say this movie and like Animal House and other college movies kind of gave me an idea of what college would be, but they did. It's kind of like, especially for a Texas college, this was like my experience.
Yeah,
and it's majority white Texas college.
An hour of the border, so it was not that much different.
It's wild in how old this movie is, but how accurate it kind of still is. Ew, I hate to say that out loud. Ew, except there's just smartphones now.
No, but yeah, it's true. And like, I would say I always felt lucky that I went to a school big enough where you could ignore the Greeks in a way. It was so mm-hmm. big that there are enough of us that you didn't have to care. Mm-hmm. And, but I also remember the inequality of it. Like, we had awful cops in our town. Horrible cops. Terrible, mm-hmm. terrible, 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 terrible. And I could go on for days about how terrible they were about like rape and stuff. Awful. But our cops got worse and worse and worse because I was there while we were winning football games. And so they got more money was flowing into the town. The cops got more aggro, more protective. All of our cool bars started to close down for alumni stuff, expensive stores. Awful time. You really saw the town change. But like by the time I graduated, when we, the quirky kids, of which I would say there were like 300 of us, when we would throw one of our big parties, the cops would always come and shut it down by my senior year. Always. And then for kicks, I thought, I'm going to go to a frat party before I leave. So I went to a frat party my senior year, and the cops were there handing out beer. And I was like, are you kidding me?
It's disgusting.
I was so mad. So mad. Because I felt like we were persecuted in that town. We couldn't have our parties. We'd have to plan three house parties in a row, and we would all move from one to the other because they would keep shutting us down.
Because
they're handing out beers for the other guys.
Like, that's how it, like, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I think at A&M, like you said, it was easy to ignore the Greek system, but at A&M, it's the Corps of Cadets, which is the big thing. And I, for those who don't know, A&M was started as a military school. They actually didn't let women in until like the 70s or 60s or something like that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I may be wrong about that, but I just know it was originally an all-male military school. The Corps of Cadets really does still exist there. Like, but they started to kind of let, you know, civilians in. And I went there, and where I lived, the dormitory was right next to the quad, which were all the Corps of Cadets stay. So that was an interesting experience because they had to wear uniforms every single day, and you could tell who, like, if you were, you could tell who was a freshman, junior, or freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior by the uniform by themselves. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, freshmen, very plain. And then, like, sophomores, I think they, you know, and then juniors, there is, like, you know, emblems or something. But if you were wearing, the goal was wear your senior boots, because I had friends who were in the Corps, and that's a big deal. So if you wear boots, that's, you're a senior, you're a fourth year. It's so wild. They are the alpha betas.
That's terrible. I'd be freaked out seeing people in military-esque things marching around.
I know, but it kind of was like, I remember walking around, I was like, so, you know, rave culture was like huge, right? Well, yeah. Now it's big again because JNCOs are back in style. And I would
I was in college in the JNCO era too.
Me too. So I was like such a, like, I was a sore thumb in A&M. I would change my hair color every single week. I'd wear JNCOs, wide leg jeans. I would be so like anti-establishment and, you know, whatever. I was like a big smoker. I was a fuck the system. I thought I was a spoken word poet. That
wow.
But I digress. But yeah,
at the library like a proper Omega Mu.
I did have a job. I actually worked at the student disabilities office, I remember. Okay. I only worked like 5 hours a week, which paid me like $50, I remember. And $50 back in those days, guys.
Yeah. That was a whole week of drinking cheap beer at a college bar.
At a college bar, and also getting $1 Jumbo Jacks or 99 cent tacos from Jack in the Box.
Oh my God. I lived on the Jumbo Jacks because they were still doing dollar Jumbo Jacks the summer I moved to LA, and, you know, moving here on like minimum wage, Midwestern Oklahoma money doesn't go far. But lived on the dollar Jumbo Jack.
Dollar Jumbo Jack. But I'm guessing they're not dollar anymore, are they?
No. I ate one for the first time in like years about 3 months ago, and I think it was $5 for the sandwich.
Oh my God!
Fine. Yeah, just the sandwich. I didn't get anything else because whatever.
I remember one of my friends said he measured his money in Jumbo Jacks. Like, he would be like, "Oh, $10? That's 10 Jumbo Jacks."
I want to correct his math with tax, but it's fine.
But nine. Yeah, I mean, I was like, I get it. I get what you're doing, but you know, you need to be accurate with your math.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta adjust. But actually that's interesting because somewhat related to that, when they were shooting Revenge of the Nerds on the campus of University of Arizona, it was the fraternities and sororities who petitioned against the movie even being made. Cause like the sororities, I think, got a copy of the script, and the sorority council hated the line, "We've got Bush."
We've got Bush.
Oh, hell pie.
As well they should. They were not wrong. They hated it. And so they shut it down for a little bit. And like, it took a couple weeks for it to get back online. And like, they agreed that they could keep making the film. And it's like, you see the power of the Greek council represented in this movie. And they also shut down the film. But they were also correct about why that line really sucked.
That is just like this movie. Have you ever thought of doing an oral history on this, on Revenge of the Nerds? You should.
Maybe someday. It's like, I get scared talking about the things I love that I know are
problematic,
which is why we're here.
But also, I don't think you don't love the bad parts. You love this movie because it represents a time of cinema. It represents like this certain time of cinema where we were just like, oh, let's just show a lot of boobs, be racist, misogynistic, homophobic, and see what happens. And it's like, it's fascinating. I mean, I don't agree with any of that, but it's just fascinating how, you know, us as humans, like we just kind of like, oh, that's okay. You know, but all of a sudden it's just like, how could we have thought that was okay? But you think in context during that time, look at who was in charge. Look at who was making the choices and the decisions. You know, it's just like, there's a reason why it's problematic, because we had problematic people running things, you know?
And if anything, I think one thing we're really seeing today online is, in a way, there's a power in declaring yourself the underdog or declaring yourself the victim. And in these movies, Animal House included, going back further, we have this culture of movies where people declare themselves underdogs, and then we live long enough to see those underdogs become the oppressors. And it just happens over and over again.
Oh my God. We live to see the underdog become the oppressor. Wait, it's kind of like, what was the movie, The Villain? You know, we see all, I'm going to even like say something like Joker, you know, it's like, we see these people we would normally root for turn into a horrible thing, right? And that's like, oh my God, it's like, I'm like thinking of so many people
it's so
in our culture. It's just like, oh my God, it's like, oh, ew, 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 you know? And
And it's fascinating because, like, we as audiences don't always give the movie credit for knowing what they're saying. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this is everything Taxi Driver's about, or like King of Comedy. Scorsese was trying to say this then. Mm. And now we're like, we were like, no, that movie is problematic. And then we're like, no, you're actually correct. And you're warning us. That whole kind of parsing of like depiction versus endorsement and like when it starts to blur. It
exactly
the same thing, sort of.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I do feel like these movies are like learning moments, right? Mm-hmm. For people like us, at least, or it teaches us this history that we don't want to repeat about how we've changed as humans and how we don't necessarily need to pat ourselves on the back, but we could be all, wow, we're just a little bit less trashy than we were back then.
Right? Like when they rewrote Revenge of the Nerds more recently to make it a musical, I think, for stage or something. Uh-huh. The original writer changed how the love story worked. Love story. Sorry, I don't even like calling it a love story. But like...
The relationship
between Lewis and Betty, they changed it. So now she's in danger of being kicked off the cheerleading squad because she's failing trigonometry. And Lewis teaches her trigonometry. And in that gift, she realizes he's a good guy.
That is such a Can't Buy Me Love moment. That is so Can't Buy Me Love, starring Patrick Dempsey. What's also interesting in how long this nerd narrative lasted, because it lasted well into the 90s, because we have the nerd narrative with Saved by the Bell, right? We see like that because like,
oh yeah,
Saved by the Bell.
And look how creepy Dustin Diamond turned out. I mean, my
exactly.
God.
And it's like RIP, but you know, still. It's
and don't get me started on Mr. Belding going to karaoke nights in LA. Good. Oof,
No, but it's weird because it's just like all this nerd narrative of what a nerd is carried through. We didn't really, I guess we kind of saw it also in like 90210.
Yeah.
We saw it in Saved by the Bell, even like in those Saturday morning live action California Dreams like shows. We saw this Urkel, you know, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, we see this nerd thing, but now I'm like wondering when we started to see that shift. I want to say early 2000s with like the Dawson's Creeks of it all and stuff like that.
Right, because she was bookish. Felicity was bookish.
But she was mysterious. So Revenge of the Nerds was released, 20th Century Fox. Well, back then it's called 20th Century Fox. Now it's just, what is it now? They've got whatever
20th century 24 whatever think, it is it's done
yeah whatever it is done yeah but it was released on July 20th, 1984. I believe the budget was $8 million. It opening weekend, it actually really did well on opening weekend, $1.5 million. That's a lot for a comedy. Yeah. Total box office, there's no international, 40.9 million for a box office for a comedy. Pretty good. Rotten Tomatoes, it currently has a 71% on Tomato Meter, 73% audience score based on 50,000 plus ratings. The original review in The Hollywood Reporter in 1984, I forgot who wrote this, but it said, while much is in the Animal House vein and quite funny, several tasteless episodes mar the film. Which actually is quite accurate, right?
Very much. Yeah, I would agree with that.
And then the review also says, as the nerds, Carradine and Edwards are convincing, especially with their strange sucked in laughter. That iconic whatever donkey noise.
That James Cromwell does.
Yeah, James Cromwell plays Carradine's dad.
Yeah.
You know, that's wild too, to see such a, you know, A-list actor. Well, also Anthony, there's a lot of A-list actors in this movie, honestly. McGinley as the Wasp bully boy is smooth and exudes a strong stage presence. As a blonde, oh my god, this is a horrible thing. As a blonde sorority bitch, Julie Montgomery is appropriately snide and winning. While Bernie Casey as the black frat head is nimbly effective. Technical credits under Jeff Canu's fast-paced direction sometimes carried away production. That's weird. Revenge of the Nerds is on number 91 on Bravo's 100 Funniest Movies. This spawned several sequels, including Part 2, Nerds in Paradise in 1987, Part 3, The Next Generation in 1992, and Part 4, Nerds in Love in 1994. Did you follow all of these? Are you familiar with all
of
them?
No. Maybe I watched a little of Paradise, but I don't even think that happened. I definitely kept up a lot more with the Police Academy franchise than
Nerds. Yeah. Again, another film franchise in the same ilk. Mm-hmm. There was a remake, you probably know this, that was supposed to be executive produced by McGee, speaking of problematic, and directed by Kyle Newman, that was slated for 2007 with Adam Brody, Kristen Cavallari, Jenna Dewan, and Efren Ramirez. And it was canceled after 2 weeks of filming, I guess.
That was a period in which we had cycled back to this type of humor.
The world. Right. Yeah, we didn't need it at that time. Seth MacFarlane announced a reboot in December of 2020, with the Lucas twins, who were supposed to write and star in the film, but there hasn't been any updates since then. Peter Baldwin directed a pilot that was never picked up, but it was included on a DVD release of the movie. Have you seen the pilot for Revenge of the Nerds? So apparently it's on the DVD release of the movie. So I never did. And you said there was a Broadway musical?
I think they tried a musical version of it, at least. I'm not exactly sure what that happened, but yeah.
It probably never went to Broadway, or like it probably tried to go to Broadway.
Yeah.
But there was, remember the reality series, King of the Nerds?
I never saw it, but yeah.
It was hosted by Booger and Lewis, or Carradine and Armstrong. They hosted it, and it lasted 3 seasons. I thought it was only one. It went from 2013 to 2015. And then there was not a Lambda fraternity before the film, but it ended up becoming a fraternity in real life in University of Connecticut in 2006. So that is
kind of rad. And I think they deliberately designed it to be like open and co-ed and non-discriminatory to sort of live up to what the movie promised. And from what I've read, I think it has 6 chapters now across 4 states, which is that's a real world effect from this movie.
And I think that kind of, again, goes with it's a fave, but it's problematic, kind of how this kind of representation really does matter. Like, to see a movie like this birth an actual fraternity that is all welcoming of just anyone speaks highly of this movie, even though it is trash. You know?
Very much.
Yeah.
And I want to, if you don't mind, I pulled 2 reviews, too.
I'm a nerd.
By the way, I looked up the history of the word nerd, and nerd is a word that came from Dr. Seuss. He invented it in 1950 in the book If I Ran the Zoo, and it started off meaning just like a square, and then it evolved to mean like a smart, socially awkward square. And then when Fonzie started to say it a lot on Happy Days, it turned into like a much more popular word. And some people say that the origin is actually not from Seuss, but that it's because, like, if there are 2 types of people on a campus, the, like, cool guys and the dorks, then the cool guys are drunk, and drunk backwards is nerd, K-N-U-R-D.
Oh, my God!
I don't know if I buy that, but that is one theory, that it's the opposite of somebody who parties. Had to put that out in the universe.
I like it. Nerd. K-N-U-R-D. Yeah.
We can run with that. But, like, you know, early on I mentioned that, like, I am interested in this idea that, like, people knew things were problematic when they came out. People knew Birth of a Nation sucked when it came out. They knew.
Yeah.
They protested. It happened. And the New York Times called this movie out when it came out. You know, they said that the film's, quote, like, fundamental attitude of condescension and scorn toward Blacks and women and a tendency toward stereotyping clashes violently with its superficial message of tolerance, compassion, and fair play. Absolutely fair thing to say. And they nailed it. They nailed it when it came out. And then I found this piece that wasn't a review, but it's from the Los Angeles Times in 1985, the year after, where they finally caught up with it. And they really wrestled with everything we're talking about. And I was astounded by this. And it's a little long, and I'll try to read it fast.
Go ahead.
Okay. So it's springboarding off a quote that Jeff Canoe, the director, said himself. He said, "The studio's instruction to me was, quote, give us Animal House. I gave it to them, but I tried to layer it with some humanity and real characters." So this writer says, analyzing layers of humanity can be tough. One man's layer might not be another's. Was the, and again, I'm using 80s words here, sorry, was the mincing black dancer layered since he was proudly gay, or a limp-wristed laugh-getter? Was the Japanese student layered since he was smart, or pathetically horny, slavering over bare breasts and genitalia? Was the bespeckled girlfriend a caricatured four-eyed nerdette, or was she layered because she surprised us by becoming sexually aggressive? One likable nerd ripped the clothes off a young woman and chased her down a hallway until she was saved by the overweight house mother. I don't think she was layered. Then he pivots into something fascinating. He says, the nerds had turned violent, criminal, viciously misogynistic. The sorority girls had acted snobbish, the filmmaker seemed to be saying, so didn't they deserve a little mauling and humiliation? Then it struck me that Canoe and company had something much deeper in mind. Probing the nerds' psychological duality, their dark side, more layering. And in the final bonfire scene, the layers of humanity were so thick that you could hardly tell who was who anymore. And I realized that was just the point, one way or another, all different, yet all the same, all a bit ineffectual and insecure in some way, all deserving of compassion, understanding, love, except, of course, fat house mothers, humiliated women, and oversexed Japanese. You cannot be expected to layer everybody with humanity, not when you have a chance to make layers and layers of money.
Oh my God, that we went back into time and wrote that.
Isn't that right? Probing their psychological duality and their dark side. If that was true, I love it.
I think it's like, it's so interesting, like listening to you say that. It's kind of like the nerds won because they were finally cool.
Right?
It's like, and it's kind of like what this movie, I guess it's like all, they basically gave into culture, right? You know, into, they're like, oh, this was more about like, oh, please accept us, you know, instead of like, oh, we just want to live our lives the way we want to. They were begging to be accepted. And I think everyone is, right? But that, I need to read that whole article now.
I'll send it to you. That's interesting. I came across it yesterday. I was like, oh my God.
It's this, I never realized, it's like we always kind of write this movie off as like a cult classic, right? But it has just as much layers as something as Fast Times at Ridgemont High, I feel. But this one, unfortunately, is not. I'm sure there won't be a Criterion collection for Revenge of the Nerds.
That's the thing, but you make a couple really awful things and you're screwed. You cannot Criterion connection a movie with a rape. It just can't.
Yeah, it's just weird. It's just like, oh, this movie is... I think that's another reason why I do this podcast is just because, you know, we're kind of rediscovering these things also. It's just like, oh, wow. Imagine, you know, it reminds us like, oh, we need to kind of keep evolving and changing, because if we do stay in one place, then this is what happens. You know, it's like stuff like this happens.
Anything we're going to see this year. I mean, we could love us something this year, and in 40 years, people are going to be like, what was wrong with Amy and Dino? They were wrong.
Yeah! Like, even, like, I'm sure, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, which is out right now, I'm sure there's something already wrong with it. People are mad. And also, everyone is hyper-vigilant on how to be mad these days. So, it's they're like, not how to be mad. They want to be mad at something. Yeah. I just want to be happy with something.
In a way, learn. I was thinking about this yesterday because it is something I wrestle with a lot. The internet is such a negative place of everybody giving unsolicited advice and criticism, because at heart, the core emotion is everybody wants to feel like they have something to contribute to a conversation. And it's just easier to think of something bad than it is to think of something positive, because most positive stuff sounds the same. But if you can think of a new way to say that somebody did something wrong, you sound smart. And I do feel like there's just a little bit of that happening. That doesn't mean all critiques are wrong. It just means I feel like that's why there are so many critiques.
Yeah, because everyone wants to be heard no matter what it is, right? Especially within the whole Twitter culture of it all. And now I feel like, I don't want to say it's getting worse, but it's not getting better, you know?
Yeah.
Especially with the changes at Twitter. You know, everyone kind of, now everyone is, I feel like, all if I can't go to Twitter, where am I going to go? So, you know, and I just think everyone's holding on to Twitter for dear desperation. And I'm like, oh, I'm kind of backing away from it slowly,
yeah.
If I'm being honest. I still have it because it helps. But at the same time, I'm just like, oh, one day I made a comment on a picture on Instagram. Because I forgot what it was, but as soon as I posted it, people started commenting on my comment saying, well, you're wrong about, I just made a simple comment. And they're like, oh, well, you should have already known this. You were, and then it just kind of like, oh, I thought I was doing something good, but now I'm getting criticized for a comment I made that really wasn't a critique. It was just like, oh, I remember this. And then they're like, oh, well, this is old news, you know, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Like, I was like, oh, this is why I don't comment on anything anymore, because
yeah,
you're not going to have an emotionally mature conversation. That's impossible online. In person, it's fine. Online, it's a different story.
I know. I almost hope we're going back to kind of like the climate you described in college, where you just met up with your friends all the time and talk to people in person, because like,
yes!
This is exhausting. I haven't been on Twitter since January. Before then, I was weaning myself off to only logging in one day a month or one day a week. And I have to say, I finally have hit the point where I don't miss it, but I'm on Instagram too much. And now I have to really get off that.
Yeah. And I think Instagram's a little bit, it's not as toxic as Twitter is.
It's and, not, but yeah. it is why I was thinking about this. Cause like one of my friends had a kid recently and like, I became aware of like anytime somebody posts a picture of a kid, there's like 9 randos in the thing being like, hold your baby this way. No, hold your baby this way. And I was like, right. Everybody has to say something and it can only be negative because they don't know what else to do.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, just say an emoticon goes a long way. A heart emoticon, a smiley face. I know it's lazy, but it goes a long way and it could mean multiple things, right?
Exactly.
So Revenge of the Nerds. This is probably one of the best problematic things, just because, you know, just because it's a weird movie and it's a horrible, it treats women horribly, it treats Asian people horribly, queer people horribly, but also I feel like it's always taking one step forward and like 5 steps back, sometimes even 10 steps back. And I feel like when this movie was being made, as you said, the director was like, oh, he wanted to create Laird. His intention was there. But as that LA Times article read, it's just like, oh, you wanted to create Laring, but you created these horribly one-dimensional characters that are only there to either show their boobs or be humiliated or both. You know, it's usually both.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Amy, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Coming
this
on
has been
here.
Such a pleasure. We got to go get like proper, the best version of San Antonio Mexican food we can have out here.
Where? Usually
we got to go to those old school places where they just put too much cheese on everything. That's the closest I can find. Like,
have you, El I mean, Compadre. Like, I, El Compadre. I actually like El Compadre.
El Cholo.
El Cholo.
El Coyote.
I don't like El Coyote. I'm really? Not a fan. I will go to, you know, we'll go to a, of course we'll go to a home state because that's the closest thing.
Yeah, it's not, it's the closest thing. Don't you think they have too many ingredients?
Too many ingredients. Sometimes all you need is an egg and potato.
That's it. 2 ingredients tops. Cheese.
Maybe cheese.
Dubious as an ingredient.
But I get that we're in LA and you have to have a egg white mushroom black bean thing, which I'll eat begrudgingly.
But let's be real, they're just making little burritos. It's not a breakfast taco.
There's
it's
and
a
there's
little
too,
burrito.
Too much eggs, guys. Too much egg in the breakfast tacos, home state.
Everybody thinks I'm crazy, but I know a real San Antonio person will know what I'm saying.
Because we like home state. Okay, if you're listening, home state.
Yeah, if you're listening.
Go to San Antonio, go to Austin, go to like a Taco Cabana, go to a local taqueria, anything. Order all the breakfast tacos they have and just copy that.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we ask you to do.
2 ingredients. They're bean and cheese. I will let them live. The homestead bean and cheese, you're fine.
refined.
But I want like a real classic egg and potato. Just the most classic, basic yes. one. Nothing but salt and a little bit of salsa.
Yeah, that's all you need. You don't need all the bells and whistles. All you need, I think, at max four ingredients. At max.
Ooh, now you're getting crazy.
Fourth one is optional because, you know, if you want to cater to the California audience, I feel like you need to give them that variety because they think they're doing something.
I think they need to come back to us. Get their burritos, consider it a separate thing. And then if they want a true, pure taco. Convince them it's like sushi. Yeah. Minimalist.
What if?
Essential.
What if Home State had two menus? One for us. And then one for everyone else. For San Antonio, Texas, local natives, and then everyone else.
Yeah. Otherwise, they're just going to be getting what they're getting from me, which is I'll go and I'll buy their tortillas, but I won't get their tacos unless I'm really hungry.
Yeah, exactly. Because I remember one of the secrets when I used to go to Taco Cabana back in the day in Texas is like I would always get a bean and cheese taco and an extra tortilla because then you would get two bean and because they would always put and then you could put some bean and cheese in the other tortilla and you'd have two tacos. Again, this was during the I'm broke days, but but Amy, you also host your own co-host a podcast, Unspooled, with someone. Can you tell us a little bit about your pod, which I enjoy?
I'm the co-host of a podcast called Unspooled, which I do with Paul Scheer, the awesome comedian who does How Did This Get Made. He's in a bazillion TV shows and movies, and he has this one that I really love called Black Monday. That show's so
Black Monday's excellent.
So y'all. Good. I feel like people slept on it. I'm like, wake up, watch Black Monday. Unspooled started with us going through the whole AFI Top 100. Just being like, what are these movies like? Let's like really check them all off as like the ultimate education. And then when we were done, we realized we can kill like 60 of them and they're gone. So now we're just rebuilding it and following our own curiosity, trying to fill it out. We got rid of all the Westerns and almost all the World War II pictures and so many 70s things. Now we are seeing what's missing. And that's been
I saw your last episode. What's your latest episode?
Weirdly, we just did Blazing Saddles. So I was like prepped to talk about problematic faves.
Well, that's good. And do you have anything else? Do you have like an album dropping soon or anything that you want to talk?
Not much, except I review films for the New York Times, which is just such a joy every week.
Good. And where can our listeners follow you? I know you said you're not on the Twits, but you are on the Instas. Are you like on the TikToks or anything else?
I'm not. I can't. Yeah, I'm just hiding on the Instas. And my name on there is just my name, Amy Nicholson, and the Amy Nicholson, which I regret that it sounds pompous, but there's a lot of Amy Nicholsons, and the Amy Nicholson was the one that was left. So it's what I got.
Well, that's good. But thank you so much for joining. This was, I love this conversation. I mean, I know we could talk about Revenge of the Nerds longer, but then we'd be here another hour and I think my editor would like that. So, But thank you so much, Amy, for talking with us here at Problematic Fave.
Such a pleasure, buddy. Let's go hang out.
Revenge of the Nerds. We'll get tacos.
Problematic Fave podcast is presented by Diaspora and is created, hosted, and produced by Dino Ray Ramos. The series is also produced by Sanjay Sharma of Marginal Media Works and edited by Brian Aguilar. Special thanks to Cam. Subscribe to Problematic Fave on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate us. Diaspora is a media platform that amplifies intentionally exploited communities through its work. Follow Diaspora at Real Diaspora on Instagram and Twitter, or visit thediasporatimes.com. Follow Marginal at MRGNL Media on Instagram. You can send us all your problematic faves on social or email us at thisisdiaspora@gmail.com.